All right, I think we're gonna start because I think there might be a class right now. Anyway, so I'm very happy to introduce Rob Goodnow. He is currently at the American Museum of Natural History. I've actually known Rob for quite a while. He was on my thesis committee, and I consider him like a friend, a very dear friend. So he got his Bachelor of Arts from University of Chicago. I don't know what your name is.
It was the 70s, I don't think I had it.
He actually wanted to be a social worker.
It was news to me that I went to the University of Chicago.
Okay, so he actually started out wanting to be a social worker, then he wanted to work with whales, I think. But he actually hung out in the Field Museum of Natural History in Chicago a lot, and he did a lot of his undergraduate research projects there. And he then went on to graduate school in Washington University in St. Louis, under Alan Templeton, that's your thesis advisor. And he was studying Hawaiian fruit fly evolution using molecular genetics, one of the first people who actually started doing that. So his work caught the attention of Alan Wilson, who's in UC Berkeley, many considered to be the father of modern molecular evolution. And he, after that, he did another postdoc with Dan Hart in Washington University. The two postdocs combined were actually just 2 years, and my own postdoc was actually 6 years long. So I guess times have changed. Then he moved to Yale for his first position as an assistant professor. I guess Yale wasn't what he wanted. And then he moved to the American Museum of Natural History as an assistant curator, where he stayed until today. So now he's a curator. He also had a judge position in New York University, Columbia University, City University of New York. He teaches in all these places. That's why I actually met him, because I was at NYU when he was teaching there. He is on the editorial board for many well-regarded journals over the years, and still is. He's actually a prolific author of hundreds of journals in his field, as well as a lot of interesting books. One of the most favorite ones of mine is actually The Science of Jurassic Park in the Lost World, which I'm very proud to say I have an autographed copy of. And I think he's actually now writing, he just told me he's writing a book on wine, which I also want an autographed copy of. So. All right, he's Rob.
Yeah, and that Science of Jurassic Park book is available on the web for like 50 cents. So. I love coming to entomology departments. As I was talking with Phil, and we went into the lab and talked to the students, and we stood in front of a picture of an ant penis for 15 minutes and talked about the ant penis. So it's really a lot of fun to come to an entomology department. And then you give a lecture in a room with a museum exhibit hanging from the ceiling. So it's really great to be here, and thanks to Joanna for asking me. I'm not going to talk too much about insects, though, so those of you who thought I was going to talk about insects can get up and leave. But what I'm going to talk about is mostly about the tree of life, and it really doesn't matter what you're talking about when you talk about the tree of life, but it does matter if you're talking about the tree of life being dead. Then you're pretty much going to want to talk about bacteria and archaea. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that. Of course, the whole idea of life being represented by a tree comes pre-Darwin, really. But Darwin was the one who pretty much solidified it as a part of modern evolutionary biology with his great tree of life metaphor and On the Origin of Species. If you look through On the Origin of Species, you'll find some just beautiful passages with respect to his thinking that trees were great metaphors for how life evolved on this planet. And through his writing, his notebooks, which you see down on the bottom right, his famous I Think figure, he articulated why thinking in a tree way is a very good way to think about life on the planet. And through his writings to to his colleagues, such as this quote from a letter to J.D. Hooker in 1858, just before he published On the Origin, he says, "I'll do something to when I discuss the principle of divergence, which along with natural selection is a keystone of my book." And I have very great confidence it is sound. And this principle of divergence he thinks is just as equally as important as natural selection, and you know, this principle of divergence essentially is, let's think about things in the context of trees. And then let's flash forward about 140, 150 years, and we see that our view of the tree of life is something like this, and this is before we started to sequence a lot of genomes, and then our view of the tree of life turns into this, and we probably see this figure all over the place. And the reason for this, of course, is that microbes like to toss things around via transduction, conjugation, or transformation. And each of these mechanisms causes a mix-up in how you interpret the trees that you're interested in. So, for instance, if you think the phylogeny is 3 with 4, then 2, then 1, well, horizontal transfer or horizontal gene transfer, HGT, which is what I'm going to probably call it throughout the rest of the talk, will alter the tree topology to give you something that's not the quote-unquote true tree. And also, at another level, we have what's called the gene tree species tree problem, and it's kind of related to HGT, but there are other reasons for the gene tree species tree problem, which are related to incomplete lineage sorting. And this causes a similar problem in interpreting trees and I guess, trusting the information that you get from information where you're going to use to build a tree. And these two problems have become very, very acute as a result of genome sequencing. Back when I was a postdoc at Berkeley, we didn't have this problem. We didn't think about this problem. This problem was nowhere in anybody's mind. And only through genome sequencing did these problems really come to the fore. So there's a lot of talk in the literature, especially from Ford Doolittle's group, about a lack of support for tree thinking. In other words, the bifurcating history of life doesn't work in some groups and in others. This was a particular study that was done that showed that a genome level analysis of a group of organisms, of several groups of organisms, resulted in incongruent trees from individual genes. And my group actually has done some work similar to this. This is a group of Pastor Lacey that we worked on. From whole genomes, constructed the phylogenetic matrix and then did phylogenetic analysis on them. And the striking result that we got here is that in the top graph is all the genes in the genome, whether or not they're represented by all the taxa. So there's some incomplete taxon representation for some of the genes. But the number of genes is on the y-axis, and the number of nodes that the tree for that particular gene agrees with the total evidence tree is shown on the x-axis. And it turns out that no single gene actually recovers the total evidence tree out of the 2,000 or so genes that were in this analysis. And on the bottom are the 633 genes that are present in all 14 taxon analysis. And in this case also, no single gene recovers the total evidence or the concatenating hypothesis. But if you look at the hypothesis that you get from concatenating, the result is that you get strong inference for a specific topology, and that is the concatenated topology. In essence, every node in this tree has 100% bootstrap jackknife, and spacing posteriors equal to 1.0. So now you go back to the thinking that this tree thinking doesn't work in yet another paper, and they say in this paper, to sum up our arguments thus far in a single sentence, the belief in the existence of a universal tree of life inclusive of prokaryotes is stronger than the evidence from genomes to support it. And in fact, we should researchers say that we should be thinking about the tree of life as a comb of life. And I use a sentence from a review of a paper that I was a co-author on to express this sentiment. Recently, whole genome prokaryotic and tree of life phylogenies has been viewed as a useless, inscrutable endeavor, basically because that's the endeavor that I tried to get published. And this is because of the prevalence of horizontal gene transfer. And it's safer to assume a comb-like topology of life. And this safe topology would be a soft polytomy, that is, one where we have a lack of resolution at deep nodes in the tree. Now, can we really think about the tree of life this way? And so what I want to do is try to show you some ways that we've tried to think about the tree of life and to try to come up with arguments for the tree of life. And in this first study, I want to show you what we did here is we used different E-value cutoffs. And those of you who do a lot of genomics will know what an E-value is. It's essentially a criterion that you use for establishing enough similarity to call something the same. And in this case, we constructed matrices in the slides I'm going to show you, at many different E-values. And then what we do is we identify all the gene families with more than one gain on the optimal tree. So we can take the optimal tree and we can map the presence and absence of each gene in a particular gene family onto that tree. And then what we can do is identify gene families with more than one gain on the tree and with multiple 0-to-1 changes, and we call these horizontal gene transfers. And then we can test if the exclusion of HGTFs improves phylogenetic resolution or consistency by removing the quote-unquote misleading homoplastic phylogenetic signal that are in HGT genes. So it's just a process of identifying genes that are HGT on the result as a result of looking at their reconstruction on a phylogenetic tree, and then taking that category of genes, pulling them out, and doing an analysis to see what happens. And so these are just a couple of examples to show you how we scored whether or not a gene was HGT. In the top figure, the reconstruction is very, very simple. There are two 0-to-1 transformations in that tree. That, therefore, is what we would call an HGT. In the bottom figure, there are different ways to reconstruct this character on this tree, but in essence, it boils down to two 1-to-0 changes and two 0-to-1 changes. And again, we count one HGT, and this gene family would be counted as having an HGT in it. And the really nice thing about this is that you can actually see disparate patterns, such as in the tree on the bottom, and still count that as a no HGT. So this is, I think, a very conservative way of thinking about binning genes as either HGT or as not HGT. And so, if you look at a variety of E-values and you count the total number of genes in an analysis and the total number of non-HGT genes in an analysis, the blue line and the red line is total, and the HGT genes is the green line, you find that about 1/7 or so of the genes at an E-value of 50 are HGT. So the idea here is that if like 50% or 75% were HGT, then we should be afraid. Then we should be very afraid. But given that it's not an immense number, then this is somewhat encouraging that HGT, at least when you use it as a phylogenetic tool, is not overwhelming. And these figures just summarize the percentage and the extent of horizontal gene transfer in different trees, in a combined tree, an amino acid tree, and a presence-absence tree, and it never exceeds 7.5%. And per gene, it's maybe 17-18%, as I showed on the previous slide.
Rob, what were the organisms again?
This is a whole genome tree from 170 eukaryote and archaeal and bacterial genomes. That was constructed in 2010. Okay.
How do you get a starting tree for that?
What do you mean, how do you get a starting tree?
Well, you're mapping transfers, right?
Yes, you use the total evidence tree from that tree.
Yeah.
Okay, so what happens when you start to pull horizontal gene transfer out? What happens? Well, on the x-axis, I'm showing measures of consistency with respect to the total evidence tree. And on the y-axis is e-value. And just look at the two solid lines at the top. Those are the things that we need to look at here. And the combined data have consistency, have a tree consistency consistently 10% better than when you take the HDT out. So when you remove HDT, you're actually removing consistency from the analysis. And then finally, when you remove HDT, what happens if the combined analysis on the left and when you remove the HDT genes, you deresolve your tree. So the HDT genes are actually providing signal and providing signal for resolution in the gene trees and also providing a pretty good degree of consistency and at the same time don't seem to be overwhelming in HDT genes don't seem to be overwhelming in their number with respect to non-HDT genes. And so what you do is you take the data set and you try to publish it. And that's what we did. And one of the comments that came back from a reviewer that caused the paper to be rejected, it was, it should be completely obvious to the authors that if they took the paragraphs from the manuscript, transformed them into Lyme's genetic genes, and did this to reconstruct the phylogenetic matrix, that they and then analyze that, that they would get structured phylogenetic trees. And so, okay, let's see. And so what we did was we constructed what I call an I think matrix. And so we took On the Origin of Species and transformed On the Origin of Species into a number of matrices. You can see here the first line is I can't read it, but it's Darwin, and the beagle is in the first line, et cetera. And so you call those taxon 1, 2, 3, 4. You then pull out all the B's and O's and dashes and periods and numbers, and then you turn it into FASTA files, and you do an alignment, and then you analyze it. Pretty random, pretty exactly what the reviewer said. And we do this for 4 taxa, 8 taxa, 15, 20, and 40. And lo and behold, the reviewer is right. You do get highly structured trees. These are the trees that you get from On the Origin of Species. Using randomized data. So then you scratch your head and you go, God, this guy was right, I can't believe that. So what you do is you go, well, maybe the trees aren't robust. So you look at the first two trees for 4 and 8 taxa, and it turns out that they have bootstrap values, and those bootstrap values are above 50%, between 50 and 65% for the most part. But when you get above that, 15, 20, and 40 taxa, you get trees that look like this when you do bootstraps or just nice, or even Bayesian analysis with a Wagner WAG model. And I like to call these Vonnegut trees from Breakfast of Champions. I don't know if you've ever read Breakfast of Champions, but these refer to a specific part of the human anatomy. So given that robustness is an important aspect here, you go back and you say, well, wait a minute now. Can I come up with some way to think about a tree of life and maybe thinking my way around this criticism? And so we asked 3 really simple questions. If you put together a massively concatenated matrix, does it give you a resolved tree? And we already knew that it did give us a resolved tree, showed it to you just a second ago. Then you ask, well, is the result robust? Because if it's robust, then there might be something there. And then you have to ask, is the resulting tree biologically meaningful, whatever that means. But I'll try to give you an idea of what that means. So what we did was we constructed, and I should have had this slide earlier to tell you how we constructed this matrix. We construct a super matrix where we concatenate the presence-absence information for each gene family with the sequence information for each gene and gene family. This is a matrix with over 7 million characters and about 1 million phylogenetically informative characters. And then we analyze that, and we ask, does it give a massively concatenated matrix? And yes, it does. And then we say, well, is the resulting tree robust? And this is the tree with decay indices on it. And the data for support measures are shown here. The number of percentage of nodes that have 50% to 75% jackknife or 2, and it'd be the same for bootstraps. 75 to 95% jackknifes, there are 9 trees. And 95 to 99 jackknifes are 15 trees. The rest of the nodes in the tree, 74% of the nodes in this 169 node tree are 100% jackknifed. So yes, there's a great deal of support, robust support for this particular hypothesis. And then, is the resulting tree biologically meaningful? And it is, because if you look at the structure of the tree, the various monophyletic groups in the tree are all retained and retained at high with high robustness. So this thing passes the three kinds of tests that you can have for a tree of life over the three major domains of life. So thinking about that, then we thought, well, maybe we need to be a little bit more precise about what robustness is. So we thought about a way of analyzing concatenated data that actually allows us to address a lot of the problems that you have with concatenation. And we call this radical, it's a random addition concatenation analysis. And what we do is we take a data set with, let's say, 1,000 partitions. And then we take gene 1 and we make a tree for it and we save it. And then we take gene 2 and we make a tree for it and we save it. And we do this for all of the genes. It's gene 1 plus gene 1 to gene 10, we save the tree. Gene 1 to gene 20, we save the tree. Gene 1 to gene 30, we save the tree. So you're actually adding partitions every time you do this. And you build and save the trees, and then you compare these to a standard tree, which is the total evidence tree, of course. You could compare it to some other tree if you want, but we use the total evidence tree. And then what you do is you simply graph the consistency of the tree that you get from each of these random concatenated smaller data sets on the y-axis, and the concatenation size on the x-axis, and you get a pattern like this. And this is interesting in and of itself, right? But you want to be able to treat this statistically. So what we do is we randomize, we do multiple random addition partitions, build and save the trees, and then we get a graph for that, and then we can use statistical methods to smooth the curve. And what happens with data sets that have high consistency is you get a curve that looks like this, a curve that reaches the highest consistency that it can reach relatively quickly after a small number of concatenation events. And if you have a data set that's crappy, you get something that looks like this. And in fact, the middle ground here is is what we call the dynamics of concatenation, and we use statistical methods to integrate the area under the curve and use this as an approach to understanding the statistics of congruence amongst the various concatenated partitions. So let's go back to On the Origin of Species, and here are curves for 4 taxa, 6, 8, 10, 15, 20, and 40. And you can see that even though these guys are getting resolved trees at 4 and 8, they're showing this pattern, this dipping pattern that is indicative of a crappy data set. And in fact, if you do this to other books of Darwin, we have way too much time on our hands at the American Zoo. But if you do this with other data sets and randomize with other data sets, you in general get that pattern, although this one right here is kind of scary. Anyway, you can do this for lots of randomized data sets, and this is just a summary of a lot of the data sets that we've done. With 4 taxa, it looks like maybe you're going to get a curve that says it's a decent data set. With 6, you're starting to get something linear, but with 8, 10, 15, and 20 taxa, you're leaning more toward that pattern that says the data set is kind of crappy. And if you take real data sets, LAC is a lactobacillus data set that we generated in the lab, and MEGA is that data set that I showed you, the massively concatenated data set. And when you do these random addition concatenations for the real data sets on the top two panels, you get patterns that are showing this graph pattern that suggests that the data sets are structured, whereas if you randomize the lactobacillus data set and randomize the MEGA data set, you start to see patterns that are less than structured. That's for 4 taxa, this is for 8 taxa, this is for 15 taxa, and this is for 20 taxa. So as you increase taxa, there's less and less structure in the randomized data sets and more structure in the real data sets. And then you can smooth these and it just looks a little bit better as they're smooth. So what I hope you're seeing here is that when you get into the nitty-gritty of concatenation, the patterns of concatenation through this radical approach come out much clearer, and we're now developing some statistics that we can use to assess the robustness of saying this is the LAC curve on the top is a different curve than the LAC random curve on the bottom. Okay, so let's move on to lineage sorting, which is the other kind of bugaboo that we have to worry about. At the extreme end of the anti-concatenation crowd, there is a feeling that HDT destroys tree thinking, and also that hybridization and lineage sorting can destroy phylogenetic signal. And in essence, this destroys the classical way of thinking about trees that was started by Charles Darwin. This is, again, the gene tree species tree problem. It's prevalent in the literature. This is a study from my colleague and friend Jody Hay on the Drosophila pseudobscura group. It was probably one of the first studies to show that nuclear genes would give you different patterns. Different nuclear genes would give you different patterns. In other words, would show some lineage sorting problems. This is a study done by Dan Pollard and Mike Eisen showing. This is the Drosophila data set showing widespread discordance of genes and attributing this to incomplete lineage sorting. This is a study that was done with human, chimpanzee, and orangutan. The primates are a big subject. In this case, lineage sorting is claimed as a problem with interpreting the phylogeny of primates. This is a study from the house mouse genome showing the fine-scale phylogenetic discordance across the house mouse genome. And in this figure, the three trees for Castanium, Musculus, and Domesticus are shown in red, green, and blue. And the regions of a particular chromosome that have genes in them that agree with the red gene, green gene, and blue gene are marked on the slide here. And this indicates a widespread problem with the discordance of genes. And then there's this study from Anthony Rokas and Sean Carroll's lab showing incongruence in molecular phylogenies, and while they didn't claim this was lineage sorting, they could very easily have claimed it was lineage sorting. And this is the problem with the Rokas et al. Study. This is the problem they were looking at. The tree on the left is a completely resolved, very robust tree that they get from concatenation. And the tree on the right shows where one particular node disagreed at a high frequency with the concatenation tree, and that's a tree where you put scud and spay together as sister taxa rather than having them as grading into each other into the top three taxa, and this again could be construed as lineage sorting. But in a study done by John Gatesy down at Riverside, he pointed out that this tree that was the subject of the Rokas et al. The Rokas et al. study has various points where it can be rooted, and those are numbered in the circles. And when you root the tree, the network at the top in these circles, you get the trees at the bottom. And it turns out that of the seven ways you can root this network, and it's a solid network, five of them give you that anomalous scud with spay, a sister parent, and only two of them give you some other kind of an arrangement. And then one of the most ridiculous figures I've ever seen in a paper from John Gatesy, I told him he would never get this published because it's just the same tree written 106 different times for each of the 106 genes. But the point is that you get 106 when you remove the outgroups and you remove the potential for rooting, you generate the same tree. They're entirely congruent, all 106 genes, so the incongruence goes away. And in fact, what John showed was that the length of the root to the out group to the in group is critical in how bad the analysis is. And this top figure, the box around the figure, isn't a border around the figure. It's actually the root of one of the taxa that they use to root the in group. Indeed, if you look at the root problem in the Drosophila data set, it's pretty much the same. It's a really long root. So what I wanted to do now is talk about how random rooting oftentimes gets conflated with lineage sorting. And in essence, what we did was we constructed six different data sets. These are two. This is the yeast data set with several outgroup taxa added. And this is the Drosophila data set with other non-dipteran insect taxa added and some dipteran taxa added. The tree on the left is the primate data set, and the tree on the right is the mouse data set. And you'll notice above the taxa are numbers, and those numbers indicate outgroups that get further and further away from the in-group. So one is SCAS, which is the closest in outgroup to the in-group that was in the Rokas et al. Study, and Ananassi is one, which is the closest outgroup to the in-group that was used in the Pollard et al. Study. And so what you can do is these analyses with both parsimony and likelihood, and I use what's called a bad to good ratio. So you have a tree that taxonomists accept, that's the good tree, and then any tree that's not good is bad. And so what you can do is you can look at the genetic distance of your outgroups, do separate analysis with each of the different outgroups, and as you can see here, the slope is positive, meaning that as your outgroup gets closer to your in-group, your bad to good ratio gets smaller and smaller. So as you get your outgroup closer and closer to your in-group, you're removing the incongruence. Okay. And part of the problem, the problem doesn't go away when you use multiple outgroups either. So this shows the problem for the initial in-group sets that the authors set up. Yeah.
Did you condition the outgroup as part of the tree, or do you include that in your total data set?
The outgroup is inserted and then removed, and then the next outgroup is put in. And then removed, and then the next outgroup is put in, and then removed. So it's only a single outgroup that's doing this. But like I said, if you include multiple outgroups, the problem doesn't go away. You still get a positive slope. And that's both for parsimony and likelihood, so likelihood doesn't help it go away. So what we did when we saw this was we thought, okay, now there are other tags in these data sets that are maybe better for understanding lineage sorting. So for instance, in this data set, what they did to show what they thought was lineage sorting was they used these two and then this one right here. But now what we're trying to do in the rest of this analysis is look at taxa that are actually even closer together, where you might have a better chance of seeing and detecting lineage sorting. And in fact, the tree on the left shows the outgroup system. And when you do this, you actually add some outgroups, so it actually adds a little bit of power, and you actually get a little bit closer to the in-group by doing it this way. And when you do that, the regressions look like this. And in fact, the one interesting thing that you can do with these regressions is you can estimate the intercept, the y-intercept where the bad to good ratio is zero. And when you do that, for the Drosophila data set, the intercept is 0.016 or 1% for parsimony and 1% for, I'm sorry, it would be 10% and 16% for Drosophila. It'd be 1.6% and 1.0%, 5.4% for 8, 14.5% for maximum likelihood for 8. Yeast, the problem goes away. When you start to bring the outgroups in closer, it totally goes away. But there is one problem, and that's the mouse data set. And in this case, half to one-third of the genes are bad relative to the good. And this is what the graph looks like when you use when you graph the nucleotide distance to the bad to good ratio. This is strange, because what this means is that the genes aren't sorting into bins. They're not sorting into I agree with this tree or I agree with that tree or I. They are sorting into three different bins, but they're not sorting into one bin in particular. And what this means, if you look at the numbers, there are 370 genes that support the topology on the left, 395 that support the topology in the middle, 354 that support the topology on the right, and the orange numbers are those with significant incongruence length differences. What this means is that you're getting three categories of signal coming from the genes in this data set. But this makes a lot of sense, because these aren't species, these are subspecies. And these are Musculus, Castaneum, and Domesticus have probably been interbreeding up until about 100 years ago. And so this pattern right here is exactly what you'd expect from, or not exactly what you'd expect, but it's not totally off the wall to expect a pattern like this from taxa, quote unquote taxa, that are still reticulating with each other. And in this silly little figure, what I'm trying to say is that, you know, as populations reticulate with each other, they can maintain a bad to good ratio way above zero. But when speciation happens, that bad to good ratio should drop. And after a particular amount of time, that bad to good ratio will start to rise again as a result of homoplasia and other kinds of problems. And you know, at this point, you want to really start to think about coalescence and all kinds of other things. But this is just a cartoon to show what I think is going on. So I wanted to conclude by pointing out why a tree of life infected with HGT still bifurcates, and also point out what good is a tree of life infected with HGT. And here's just a simple thought experiment. This is a tree with 40 taxa in it, and if you have a horizontal transfer event between the ancestor of this red group and it goes to the ancestor of the blue group, then your phylogenetic inference for that particular fragment of DNA that was transferred will look like this, and those two trees only have a single node different, and what's happening is everything after the horizontal transfer event is history, and everything else in the rest of the tree is still history too. So this is why, a very, very simple explanation for why a tree of life infected with HGT really doesn't have to suffer from the infection. And in fact, from this paper from Abby et al. And PNAS recently, they actually used the presence or absence of horizontal gene transfer or lateral gene transfer as a character in reconstructing phylogeny, and they found that it was quite a good character to use. So what good is a tree of life infected with HGT? Well, the point I want to try to make with this last two or three slides is that a tree of life that you establish as a null hypothesis, so to speak, can help you a lot understand HGT, I think, a lot better, rather than just going and saying I need to construct a web and falling back on the web. A tree of life that is based on all of the evidence that you have can then tell you lots of things. And I just wanted to show you one example of this. This is a algorithm that Pervin Arcana, an informatician in my lab, has developed. And it's based on an algorithm that ecologists use, a flocking algorithm. And essentially what it is, it's a bunch of individuals floating around in space, and they interact with each other. Whenever they come in contact with each other, they make a decision to stay with each other or to repel each other. And there are other decisions that you can program into the flocking. But what happens with if you're thinking about this in the context of phylogenetics, each of those points now, instead of being an individual, is actually a gene. And when the genes come into contact, they ask each other, am I congruent with you or am I incongruent with you? And if they're congruent, at a certain degree, they'll stick together. And if they're incongruent, they'll repel each other. And so this is just a simulation study that we did to show that it works. This is for four taxa and 100 gene partitions, and each gene partition contains 100 characters without gaps or missing data. And we simulate incongruence by having 50 partitions support one topology and 50 support another, the simplest thing you can do. And this is what happens with the, this is what happens when you do the simulation and you do the flocking. They bounce around, they make contact with each other, they make a call as to whether they're congruent or incongruent with each other. You give them enough time, and one of the things that we're still trying to work out about this is what is enough time. But if you give them enough time, they will flock and sort out into the two patterns, or into the two phylogenetic patterns that are present in the data set. And so with that in hand, we decided to try it with some real data. And this is a data set using 11 Staphylococcus aureus genomes that were selected to highlight a recent introgression of about 500 kilobases of DNA. And so this 500 kilobase of DNA is going to have a different phylogenetic signal or a different evolutionary history than the genomes of these Staph aureus. And then what we do is we allow them to float around in space, make contact with each other. They'll stick together if their ILD meets a certain criterion. And from then we can actually start to think about how these things are introgressing and how the incongruence of different genes interact with each other. So there's two kinds of dots here, red and green. The green are the 500 base pair introgressing fragment, and the red are the rest of the genes in the genome. So what we're looking at here are 2,000 points, the 2,000 genes in the Staph aureus genome, and the 50 or so genes that are part of the element that came in horizontally. And what you're going to see here is that you do get some clusters of red genes, but what's really interesting is that some of the genes that are thought to be part of that introgressing piece of DNA are actually embedded within the red genes. So we can actually tease apart the genes that are part of the horizontal transfer event, and you can see the green cluster there too, being chased by the red cluster. And the green cluster will come back together again soon. But what this does is it allows us to think about incongruence of large numbers of genes in the genomes of organisms and try to get some idea of how concatenation and incongruence affects an overall phylogenetic hypothesis. And you really can't do that unless you accept that there is a tree of life, unless you accept that there is a topology that allows you to do this. And then I'd like to just finish by acknowledging the people that I worked with, and I've given Joanna this slide. These are all colleagues who I've collaborated with, and you can take a look at them when you get a chance. So thanks, and I hope that what I've done is try to convince you that the demise of the tree of life is not as bad as some may have wanted us to think, and that both horizontal gene transfer and lineage sorting can be accommodated pretty well by taking what Darwin called his great tree of life idea. And I'll answer any questions that you have.
So what is an intuitive explanation for the red blobs chasing the green blobs?
It's just the way that the simulation works. It's the way that the points are moving around is from Brownian motion. And I think what it is that the green blobs kind of like the red one, uh-huh. And they have to get up enough momentum to get away from them, and they eventually do get up enough momentum to get away from them. It's something with the way the program works, and if I knew more about how the program worked, I'd be able to answer that more precisely, but I'm pretty sure that's what it is. The reason that they're hanging close together is that there is some attraction, but then as they're allowed to wander a little bit more, they sort of separate and go off on their own trajectory.
Right.
pure. Yeah.
It's curious how you distinguish the horizontal gene transfer from other types of normal plates that you started in the first part of your talk. You give a couple of examples.
We didn't.
Simple
answer, we didn't. And that's why we felt that this was pretty conservative. We were probably lumping more things in with horizontal gene transfer as horizontal gene transfer events than there were. I mean, there are probably some homoplastic events that, as you said, that are probably being conflated with horizontal gene transfer. Although the character set that we used is gene presence absence and probably little homoplasy there.
Would you extend your conclusions about
Yeah, sure. One thing I didn't get a chance to talk about it is concept of hidden support. And hidden support is prevalent in phylogenetic analysis. And what hidden support is you have one data set gives you a tree, you have another data set gives you a tree, and the trees don't look the same. You put them together, and nodes start to emerge as a result of putting data sets together. And there's a way to assess hidden support in data sets. And it turns out that hidden support is really quite important in the concatenation process. And in the process of giving you these highly resolved, very robust trees from concatenated data, if everything was random, then you wouldn't, when you did a concatenation, if you had that Pastor-Lacy data set where no gene gave you the total evidence tree, and it was random, you wouldn't get a highly supported, robust tree after concatenating. It would not be very well supported. And so the reason that it is supported is because there's hidden support in combining things. And to expect that a single gene or a cadre of genes will give you a robustly supported resolved phylogeny by themselves. It's all about data. It's all about data interaction and hidden support. Yeah, John.
Is it possible that the gene there is the wrong unit?
Absolutely.
So if there's
I think that's why the random addition concatenation stuff works and does what it does.
Yeah.
What we're doing is we're stretching the definition of what a unit is.
But you didn't go below a gene size. Right?
No. Right. No. Yeah.
Is there something about do the HGT genes in the early part of the talk, are they more phylogenetically informative than the non-HGT genes? So other than that one node in which they conflict with the total evidence tree, is there something biological about getting transferred into an organism, a group of organisms in which that gene wasn't in, that makes them be pretty informative for those, at least for those first few branches after they're brought in.
Yes.
And so then they end up really helping with the solution.
That's exactly what hidden support is, I think. In essence, just because you have incongruence at a node where an event happens, like a HGT or a messed up lineage sorting event, the information after it is still historical. It's still going to give you the.
But do the HGT genes are they more informative?
We didn't assess that.
Yeah.
We didn't assess that. And there's an easy way to do that actually, and that is to go through and look at the congruence of HGT genes, because there's a way to quantitate the congruence of a gene at each of the nodes, and there's a way to do that, and that's actually a pretty good idea. Anything else? Yeah.
I was wondering what your results tell us on, if you could say more on how many outgroups to use. I mean, you're saying that doesn't really solve the problem with very long branches.
I don't think it's a number of outgroups. I think you just need to get your outgroup as close to your in-group as you possibly can.
And then if you have like multiple outgroups that are fairly relatively close to the in-group, that doesn't help at all?
No, it actually will exacerbate it. So if you throw an outgroup in, if you have a really close in group and you throw a really far out outgroup in, then that far out outgroup is going to exacerbate the random rooting. So you're better off You know, the parting line is use multiple operands, right? That's what you're probably taught in your systematics class. But what I'm trying to say is, no, use an outgroup that's as close to your in-group as you possibly can get. And if you need to add another outgroup, find something that's even closer than the one that you use. Because, again, by adding that, you're just asking for random rooting problems. Yeah?
If you added a series of graded outgroups that were successively more distant, not in any without any big jump,
yeah,
would that not be better than a single outgroup?
I don't think so. We've actually tried to look at that, and actually the single close outgroup will give you the best B to G ratio. You add more than one outgroup. If you add more than one outgroup and you're adding something that's further away, then that exacerbates the problem.
Because you think the outgroup's just a little bit further away, would it give you a better resolution of the ancestral states of your nearest outgroup?
That would be a good way to think about it. But what we're seeing is we're not seeing that. Again, get the outgroup as close as you can to the in-group. And part of the problem is with a lot of studies where researchers are looking at systems that have the propensity for lineage sorting. They're very, very closely related to each other, right? And so, and a lot of times, the next thing out is pretty far away. And so, again, a lot of the studies that claim lineage sorting in that context, I think, are actually conflating it with random rooting. Now, I'm not saying that lineage sorting is not a phenomenon. I'm not saying that horizontal gene transfer are not phenomena that we have to be aware of. I'm just saying that they're not deal breakers. They're not deal killers for what we do as systemists. And they're not deal killers by any stretch of the imagination for a tree of life.
All right. So, thank you, Rob.